We're gonna do some jazzercise that'll keep you fit and smiling, sugar. Swing that arm. There you go. Smile, for heaven's sake. Yeah. You ready? Now find that beat. There it is. Oh, yeah.
What's going on, folks? Hey, I wanted to do a special solo addendum episode of Everyone Gets a Trophy, where I talk about a topic that I've been getting questions about right and left. And I always get questions about this topic right and left. And it's been ever so since Mad Dog Madden was our strength and conditioning coach, and Benny Wiley and Pat Moore and Yancey McKnight, and now, of course, Tori Becton. So I want to talk about something, which we see this phenomenon every year, right? We get it, or every coaching regime change. We get a new strength and conditioning coach. And of course, the guy previous was terrible. This guy's awesome. He's cutting edge. The other guy was old school and stodgy and didn't understand. And this guy, the new guy, he applies science and he's functional. Oh, the F word that people like to throw around to impart impromptu, right, to their opinion, that it's functional, therefore you can't argue with it if it's functional. Never mind the fact that the functionality seems to stem from you're standing on a BOSU ball, hurling a medicine ball while a guy hits you with a stick. That's not functional, it's stupid. And if you don't recognize it as such, then this may not be the podcast episode for you. You may want to delete it because you're going to probably get offended. Or rather than get offended, you're probably going to post this on whatever forum that you like to hang out on, and you're going to say, Paul is stupid, he doesn't understand, blah, blah, blah. I'm telling you, I promise you, I don't pretend to be the end-all and be-all or authority on this topic, but I am telling you that I do know some things, and I do know some things that are incontrovertible, because a good deal of it relates to physics, and a good deal of it relates to things that can be empirically and objectively observed. So I'm going to give you an example of the kinds of questions that I get. And here's one from an EGAT listener. And all of you who you do want to talk to us, you always can send your questions to trophymailbag@gmail.com. Seems that during the Herman and Strong eras, SNC bulked players up and seemed to kill speed and maneuverability. There have been reports that players are faster after summer workouts. True? What are they doing different? What have you seen, if anything, yet to see if this is true? And how do you think players will hold up throughout the games? Okay. Well, various forms of that question have been barraged by those on the forums. I've been sent multiple questions like that on email. Here's the deal. So if I get a little frustrated in my tone, it is not intended at any of you who are honestly asking the question and really just wanting to know, like, what's the deal? I'm enough of a dork that I've actually investigated some of this stuff. And what I've also noticed that there's a lot of people with credentials by their names, ranging from personal trainers to kinesiology majors to even professors at universities, who it's pretty clear don't know anything about this topic either. And I know that sounds like a bold statement, but it's one I think that's supported. If you just cruise around the internet and listen to people on YouTube who are quote unquote fitness experts. So I'm not pretending to be a fitness or nutrition expert. And that's probably a good thing, because the track record of many of these health experts and their professional associations and the governmental bodies that are tasked with improving fitness is really a worship of credentialism. And I think this is an industry where a few non-experts with critical thinking skills can actually help you quite a bit in understanding how things work. So the other thing I want to dispel, I'm not a great athlete. So great athleticism is not a qualification for being able to opine on the best way to train athletes. In fact, I would argue often the very best athletes can be pretty terrible coaches. And not just on the court, but also off the court. Because a lot of these incredibly genetically gifted, unique, rare specimens don't really even understand how it is they got that way. Now, there are a subset of these incredibly genetically gifted people who also have an incredible work ethic, and they were hungry for knowledge and data, and they did what the data told them. and it made them even better and more dominant. And we know the names of a lot of these people. Michael Jordan, LeBron James. Now, would Michael Jordan have been a great NBA player without lifting weights? Yep, he would have been. Would he have been Michael Jordan? No. No, he wouldn't have been Michael Jordan. He would have been an amazing player, one of the best players of all time. He wouldn't have been Michael Jordan if he hadn't put on 30 pounds on the skinny kid from North Carolina, okay? His career would have been cut short, he would have been less durable, and he would have been less effective. What about LeBron James? Well, he is a unique genetic freak, all of his own. He's a category all of his own. Does he have a good work ethic? Sure does. Did he express all of his skills as well? He's not just a physical marvel. He's incredibly skilled. Yes, he did. Did he also work pretty hard? Yes, he did. But he is so genetically gifted, it's almost difficult to express how unique he is. This is a guy who's the size of Karl Malone, who can cover, at least at his peak before he got old, who could cover a 6'1" point guard. That's never happened in basketball before. And we've seen big, tall guys who are defensive stoppers, right? 6'8" guys, stuff like that. But they're skinny. They're 50, 60, 70 pounds lighter than LeBron James. So does LeBron James represent sort of an apogee of fulfillment of human athletic potential? Yes. Does he know everything about training? No, he doesn't. In fact, as evidence, I can point to you the fact that he missed a part of a season because he went on some crazy keto diet. He lost a lot of his strength. He lost a lot of his ability. He was playing subpar basketball for him, obviously still all-star level basketball. And he basically took a three-week vacation in the middle of the season, gained a bunch of weight back, and suddenly filled back out his muscles, and suddenly he's LeBron James again. So even a guy as gifted and as hardworking as LeBron James doesn't necessarily understand what makes him LeBron James. And he doesn't always understand the best way to train himself, as evidenced by that season. So let me talk a little bit about this topic. First, let me give a disclaimer. I don't know what the current strength and conditioning program at the University of Texas is. I don't know it. And when I do get reports, they're always secondhand. And because they're secondhand, they're always messed up. And so I'm not going to judge what anyone is doing in their program because of some secondhand report. Because what I find typically is the person who's the secondhand reporter doesn't know anything. They know even less than certainly the strength and conditioning coach, and certainly less than me, and probably less than a lot of people. And they're just sort of passing on things that they've heard or heard through a player, but it's distorted. So I cannot tell you what we're doing. I just cannot do it. I can tell you what Tori Becton has said publicly, and I can tell you what I know about Yancey McKnight, the previous strength and conditioning coach. So one of the things that we've got to talk about, and back to this question, this idea that this new strength and conditioning coach has everybody more trim, more functional, and they're more speedy and skilled and maneuverable because they're not all bulked up trying to get strong. Well, let's talk about that. Because I think there's a fair percentage of the population who thinks that agile or fast is the opposite of strong, right? that's not the case. In fact, not only are they're not antonyms, they're actually synonyms. And you're like, what? How could agility be strength? Well, actually, strength is an underpinning of agility. And it's the most trainable part of your agility beyond your natural gifts from God. In addition, bulking up, now, that is something we can talk about, but that's not necessarily related to your strength training, okay? Bulking up implies your body weight, and your body weight is a function of the law of thermodynamics. Now, it's not perfectly applied in the human body because we have hormones, we have all sorts of other inputs that make it not a perfect, clean example, but it's mostly right. Calories in, calories out. That's mostly right. I understand some of you, well, hormones. Yeah, I get that. I get all that. It's mostly calories in, calories out. Okay. For the purposes of our discussion, let's keep it nice and tidy and attribute what 90% of it is to that thing. So here's the thing. You can lift really heavy and not gain weight. Okay. You can lift really light and you can gain a bunch of weight. Because it's calories in, calories out. If you're consuming more than you're burning, you're going to gain weight. If you are consuming less than you're burning, you're going to lose weight. You're catabolic in terms of muscle mass. If you're gaining weight and you're lifting, you're typically anabolic. Now, will lifting heavy weights, and I mean substantial heavy weights and substantial exercises, core compound movements, will it help you gain quote unquote good weight while you're gaining weight? You're damn right it will. Hey, I've raved about Gabe Winslow and his amazing mortgage team since the inception of this podcast, and so many of our listeners have taken advantage of Gabe's amazing service, rock bottom rates, and tremendous follow through, and really improved their financial situation. And I wanted to read to you a testimonial that I thought was particularly relevant that we just got from a gentleman named Larry. And Larry says, Gabe, thank you very much indeed for the superb service I received during the refi process on my second home. The process was precise and relatively painless. I was surprised at how quickly everything progressed up to closing after all of the financial documents and personal information was supplied to the underwriters. The previous processes that I endured with initial mortgage process ran from another broker and lender was tedious, unprofessional, and painfully strung out over time. What you presented to me was the opposite. I thank you very much for all the professionalism and precise, timely communication that made the process essentially painless. My previous rate has been cut in half, and as such, the savings are quite substantial. I can't thank you enough for the initial contact and your urging to get this done. You were right all along, and I appreciate the continuous follow-up right up to the closing this week. And it says, warmest regards, Larry. I'll save his last name. Larry is the president and CEO of a prominent logistics company in Houston, Texas. And you may have noticed that he used the word precise a couple of times, and that probably is a good clue as to why. This is a gentleman who's really interested in evaluating efficiency of processes and delivery of product. And I think if Gabe Winslow is good enough for Larry, he probably is good enough for all of us. Find out at mortgagesbygabe.com or give Gabe a call at 832-557-1095. Once again, that's mortgagesbygabe.com, 832-557-1095. Back to our regularly scheduled programming. So let's break down this listener's question. And by the way, I'm not picking on you, listener. It's a fine question and it's a good question. But within it are some of the inherent assumptions and false dichotomies that I'm discussing. So let's break down just the first sentence of the letter. It seems that during the Herman and Strong eras, S&C bulked players up and seemed to kill speed and maneuverability. Okay, let's break that apart. Bulked players up and seem to kill speed and maneuverability. Well, how does one gain speed? The best way to have speed is to choose your parents correctly. Okay. Once we're past that, let's move past the genetics and talking about how you're going to improve speed. What's the best way to improve speed? Well, getting stronger. Okay. Are you guys starting to get a sense of the dichotomy here? You improve your speed by getting stronger. No, you don't do that. In fact, I had a track coach who said you do it by increasing your stride cadence, and then you do this drill, and you got to get more RPMs on the track. You got to have more contacts on the surface. No. What you need to do is improve your force production against the track and your body flying through the air and working against gravity, trying to pull you to it, to pull you to the surface of the earth. And the wind at your back or the wind at your face, and you are moving through a fluid dynamic, right? Even when you're moving through air. But at the end of the day, it's that track and your legs' ability to propel you and produce force on that track. And because, convenient to our discussion, you have a time modality, this is not just an expression of your speed, this is actually an expression of power. Because power has an equation. Power equals force times distance over time. Does that sound like a 100 meter dash? Absolutely. And if you can do that time in 9.8 seconds over 100 meters, we know that you are incredibly powerful because you're generating a shit ton of force. And the way you increase your force production is to get strong, because that is what strength is by definition. And how do you improve your power then? Which implies a time modality, right? The expression of your strength over time. Well, you train strength. So here's the interesting thing about the bulking up comment. Now, is it absolutely common sense that we don't want Bijan Robinson to weigh 260 pounds? Of course. Let's stay within the realm of reality here and assume like good faith in this discussion. There is a magic number where Bijan Robinson is both as strong as he can be to be fast, but also as heavy as he can be to be still agile and having good endurance and also fast, right? You don't get faster. It's not, obviously, it's not a perfect curve. You don't get faster at 290 if you're 6 feet tall. You're Bijan Robinson, right? Just because you keep adding poundage to your squat and your deadlift. Doesn't work that way. So, but what we do agree is the following. And let me give you an example of someone who bulked up and increased their speed. His name is Ben Johnson. Ever heard of him? Well, he's an Olympic gold medalist, a disgraced Olympic gold medalist from Canada. And if you know anything about young Ben Johnson, who came to Canada from Jamaica, as so many great sprinters do, young Ben Johnson was a pretty good but relatively marginal junior Olympic level sprinter. Not, I mean, very fast by any reasonable standard, but not a guy anyone was projecting to win the gold one day, okay? He was in the other group of guys. He wasn't in that elite group of guys. And he was very skinny and not very filled out. And he came across a strength and conditioning coach who also had access to anabolic steroids. And by the way, everyone Ben Johnson competed against in that Olympics was likely on some sort of PED. It's not supposition on my part. Even the great Carl Lewis, who was an amazing athlete, not to disparage him, he had positive PED tests that were thrown out. If you don't want to know about that, that's fine. That's cool. I love Carl Lewis. The reality is you do what you do to compete at that level. Okay. So when I ask you, how did Ben Johnson set the Olympic gold record? And also win the Olympic gold, how did he set the world record and win the Olympic gold? You say, oh, steroids. Well, no, that's not what did it. What Ben Johnson did was lift heavy weights real, real hard and sprint a lot real, real hard. And then he used steroids to recover from those activities. And those activities are what made him faster. And while he was getting faster, he gained 35 pounds of muscle mass. So I want to say that again. Ben Johnson got faster because he gained 35 pounds. So if you have a belief that the relationship between speed and strength or speed and bulk is one of antagonism, you need to rethink it. It's only antagonism out at the edges of the curve. Within the fat main part of the curve, most of us will get much faster when you put on more muscle, you get stronger, and you also sprint a lot. You obviously want to do the thing that you're doing, right? You want to do the sport that you're doing. The whole idea is not just to train. So what Ben Johnson did was gain 35 pounds of muscle. He went from looking like a skinny little Jamaican kid to an NFL running back. And if you want to Google an image of Ben Johnson, you'll agree with me when you see what he looks like. Now, that's an important thing to consider. And it's not the steroids that were the causal element there. The steroids provided the recovery element. The causality was his increase in muscle mass and weight, and also his massive increase in strength. Ben Johnson did bench, which, if you're confused as why a sprinter would do bench, well, then we've got a bigger topic to discuss. But he did a lot of deadlifts, squats, and bench, and he sprinted all the time. And by the time he got up to 200 pounds, he went from benching 135 pounds as a max, I'm not exaggerating, to benching about 395. Okay? That's Ben Johnson, and that's why he won the gold medal. Similarly, I'll take a different distance level. There's a guy named Sebastian Coe. Many people consider him the greatest middle distance runner of all time, and he is an Englishman. And Sebastian Coe was not only an incredible middle distance runner, he was a versatile middle distance runner, because middle distance can be defined pretty broadly. And in fact, it's very specialized. I mean, as all running sports are. You'll never see a Kenyan, right, competing against a Jamaican in the 100 meters, and you'll never see Ben Johnson or Usain Bolt competing in a marathon. I'm not sure Usain Bolt could finish a marathon. as fit as he is, he's a quick twitch creature. He's a freak, and he'd probably pull something, or he'd probably just stop running out of boredom. So I think the important thing to consider is how highly specialized running is. Yet this guy, Sebastian Coe, this Englishman, had running records that stood for 20 years from the 1970s up through the 80s as a middle distance runner between the distances of 400 meters all the way up to 5,000 meters. Now think about 400 meters. That's a lap around the track, more or less, right? 5,000 meters, that's kind of a different animal. And Sebastian Coe was elite at all these different distances between there. Why? Well, he was genetically gifted. And yes, he had an incredible oxygen max, and he had incredible mental strength, and he had all these different things. You know what he also had? He had an engineer for a father. And the best gift that this engineer for a father had is that he didn't know anything about sports. He didn't know anything about running. He didn't know anything about training. And so as like a true engineer, he intuited and reasoned that if he could get Sebastian to generate more power, Sebastian would run faster. Crazy insight, huh? Right? Because all these events are timed. There's a time modality. There is a distance, right? It's actually a defined distance. And there's force production. Now, is the force production as severe as what a 100-meter sprinter is producing? Absolutely not. And that's why their bodies look different. That's why they're differently selected athletes. But I can assure you, a 400-meter runner is running real, real hard. And if you know anyone who ever competed at that distance, and I do, I had a good friend who competed at that distance, at the end of that race, you basically just double over and want to puke everywhere. And you're spent, and it's just a disgusting attack on your body at every possible level of aerobic, anaerobic, everything. It's a sprint. There's a distance element. There's an oxygen element. It's just brutal. And what Mr. Coe's father deduced was that if he could get Sebastian a lot stronger, but also kind of watch Sebastian's weight. He didn't want to get Sebastian up to 200 pounds, right? Sebastian might get really good at running. So that's what he did. At a time when lifting weights was the most unfashionable thing fathomable for any runner of any distance, Sebastian Coe was doing hang cleans, Olympic lifts, squats, deadlifts, all sorts of stuff. Now, his program was a little primitive. It wasn't cutting edge, but it was pretty damn good for its time. And he lifted a lot of weight, and he actually gained a little weight. And in the off season, he'd gain even more weight. And then he'd trim down to running trim and retain a lot of his strength and power. And so what a lot of people attribute to Sebastian Coe's amazing endurance is actually strength. Because strength makes everything more submaximal, right? That's just common sense. If you can squat 300 pounds, and someone asks you to squat 135 pounds a bunch of times, you can do it, no problem. If you can only squat 150, you're going to squat 135 twice. Now, is the translation between doing a squat and running clean? Is it one-to-one? No, not even close. But are there elements of the squat that translate to your performance on a running track? Yeah, you bet. And what we found, and since the Sebastian Coe, and of course, Ben Johnson, is that the large majority of track athletes, although there's plenty of holdouts, will agree that you got to kind of lift weights if you want to get faster. And you know what also? You probably need to put on some weight as well if you want to get faster at those lower distances. Obviously, a Kenyan marathoner doesn't need to put on weight. That's a different specialization. It's a different subcategory. Now, is it possible that a guy's too big and too heavy and strong enough? Absolutely. What would I want to do with that guy? I'd want to lean him up a little bit. I'd want to retain his strength. I would want to retain his strength. Listen, you can retain strength very easily. So I would still have him doing some deadlifting and some squats and some other good stuff, chin-ups, etc. All this core compound stuff. And then I'd trim him back a little bit. I'd see if you got a little bit better run ratio based on his body weight if he's at 192 rather than 199. And the minute I saw a deterioration in performance of pure speed, that's where I'd stop. And then I'd try to find that perfect middle. So that's what Texas needs to do. I don't know what Tory Becton's doing. He certainly trimmed down some players. There's no question about that. Now, let's talk about Yancey McKnight and bulking players up. Well, people think that if you do heavy weightlifting, that bulks you up. No, it doesn't. Okay. I used to date a woman who was a figure competitor, not a bodybuilder. Google the difference and you'll recognize the difference very quickly. And she used to lift heavy. And she looked very feminine, particularly in the off season, right? Now, when they cut for a competition, they get all like super lean to the point where it kind of starts to look a little distorted. But in the off season, she looked fantastic. But she was doing heavy deadlifts, heavy squats, low rep range. Why? Because it made her look firm and solid. But she knew that by controlling her diet, that's how she would control her body weight and how she appeared. So the whole expression of you can't outrun your diet or you can't outtrain your diet, well, that applies to football as well. So there are a bunch of guys in a football team you want to get bigger and stronger and you want them to gain weight. There's other guys that you want them to lose some weight. And then there's other guys that you like right where they are. It's Goldilocks. So what you want them to do is maintain that weight and that strength level. And you kind of just want to build up their athletic skills. And that's what Yancey McKnight, if he had any failings, and I think he was a pretty good strength and conditioning coach. If he had any failings, I don't think he paid enough attention to the nutrition aspect of strength and conditioning, or if you will, the conditioning aspect of strength and conditioning. So he should have had individualized plans for every player. And he should have known, what's the efficacy weight that I'm going for with this player? So for Rashawn Johnson, should he get up to 245? It's a little heavy if we're trying to make him the true number two running back. Now, if you want to make him a utility player, if you want to make him a fullback slash H-back, the way the Sooners use Dimitri Flowers or something, that's not fine. That's good. 245 is probably a good weight for him. But if you're getting him up to 245 or you've got a small frame guy like Keontae Ingram and you're getting him up to the 230s, I think you're missing the boat. And what you need to have is a more disciplined program for nutrition and the weight gain aspect. You can still get people stronger gaining just a little weight. And then right before the season, you can lower that weight a little bit with more training, with more running, maybe refine their diet a little. And you can get that Goldilocks where the player got stronger in the off season because they gained weight. They're in an anabolic environment. And then when you introduce a catabolic environment, and by the way, they'll lose a little bit of strength as they lose weight. They'll lose a little bit. But the end result is a 220-pound Roschon Johnson or 225-pound Roschon Johnson who's faster, stronger, tougher, better endurance, more explosive, and he's at a good weight. He moves well at that weight. He feels good at that weight. He's more tricky. He's more explosive. Let me give you another example because people say, well, Ben Johnson was an illustration of straight line agility. Sebastian Coe, no one's running 5,000 meters on a football field. If you didn't understand the Sebastian Coe example, that's the sort of thing you would say. Sebastian Coe didn't run 5,000 meters on a football field. Well, I get it. Maybe you'd understand what I'm trying to explain here. So let me take something that the apogee of agility, of dexterity, because we're not running in a straight line on a football field. And in fact, if you gave me the choice between a crazy quick player and just a crazy straight line fast player on a football field, I'll take the crazy quick guy. Now, ideally, I'd like both. And the good news is often the two go together, but not always. Let me give you an example of a player who represents the height of quickness, of mobility, of agility on the football field. Barry Sanders. Any arguments? Okay. Didn't think so. Barry Sanders is a strength athlete. Barry Sanders was a creation of his high school powerlifting team. I'll let you say what and let that sink in for a second. Barry Sanders was a 5 foot tall, 100-pound freshman in high school. And I'm not exaggerating that. I think he was 5 foot two and 100 pounds. Okay. He was angry about how small he was. Now, obviously, he was quick. He was a little jitterbug, but he wasn't going to be effective on a football field with those comps, with those sorts of specs. So what he did is he joined the powerlifting team, and he did all the major lifts. He squatted, deadlifted, and benched. And of course, he did some other stuff. And of course, he kept running. And what happened is Barry Sanders, because he's genetically amazing and a very hard worker, he responded. And by the time he was at Oklahoma State, he was 5'8", 200 pounds, the Barry Sanders that you know in the NFL. And he was the quickest guy that I've ever seen play the running back position. And he could also deadlift 600 pounds, he could squat 550, and he could bench press 385. Did his increase in weight, he literally doubled his weight from his freshman year of high school, did his increase in weight, his bulking up, compromise his agility? Well, he also grew 6 inches. So obviously his frame also changed, but he's a squatty little dude, isn't he? Did his increase in strength compromise his agility? No. In fact, what Barry Sanders will tell you is that it improved his agility. It improved his dexterity. It improved his maneuverability. Now, would that have happened if he'd gone up to 225? Nope. There is a point in which that diminishes. And the way you know that is to run around. Be agile. Do things. Do your sport. And if you notice that you're starting to get a little bit slower because you just got too much weight for your change of direction, it's changing your leverages, it's changing your center of gravity, lose weight. But Barry Sanders would not have been Barry Sanders if he didn't find the weight room. Barry Sanders would not have been Barry Sanders if he would have graduated his high school at 150 pounds. He wouldn't have gotten a college scholarship, okay? And if he had, it would have been at Oklahoma State. It would have been Division II somewhere. Now, maybe when he discovered the weight room there, Barry Sanders would have become Barry Sanders. And he would have been this late bloomer, and he's, you know, drafted in the sixth round of the NFL Combine when he shows up and impresses everybody. But the point is, don't assume that strength or gaining weight are opposed to dexterity, agility, and speed. Often, they are companions to the fulfillment of someone's athletic potential in all areas. Now, equally, can I give you examples of players who ruined their athleticism by putting on too much weight? And spending too much time just in the weight room and not doing anything else? I sure can. And you can too. But I want everyone to understand that that is not the norm. And in fact, the way most people get bigger and stronger and faster and more athletic is in the weight room. So I just wanted to give you that thought. The other thing I want to talk about is power training. Specific power training. So what you'll see are strength and conditioning coaches who say, I don't train strength. Strength is slow, and it's just, who cares if you can squat 600 pounds if you do it slow? Football's not slow. I want you to squat 225 super fast. That's power. Okay. Again, I want to give you the power equation. This is not my opinion. It's objective. It's science. It's as objective and empirical as the law of gravity. Okay, power equals force times distance over time. It is the expression of your strength over a time modality. And for our purposes, we want that expression of strength very, very quickly. The more you can do that on a football field, the badder the MF-er that you are. And that also applies to a lot of sports. People used to argue, oh, golf, oh, no, you can't lift weights. Oh, you don't want to generate power in golf. Ignoring the most obvious basic thing that a golf swing is an exercise in power generation. And guess what? All these guys who started lifting weights, they're better golfers for it. Tennis, same deal. Guess what? Swinging a racket real hard is an expression of power. And guess who gets better at tennis by lifting weights? Tennis players. So it's amazing that there's still holdouts in the world of football, the most physical, most contact-oriented sport, or at least team sport that I know of, other than maybe rugby. And there's people that still will argue with me and other people about this. And what's amazing is some of these people are head coaches of strength and conditioning at major universities. And they're hiding out behind the amazing athleticism of the people that they train, pretending that they're responsible for that athleticism. And they're not. In fact, if anything, they're keeping some of those guys from fulfilling their genetic potential. So let me talk about that power training. The most trainable element of power is force production, and force production is strength. It's the exertion of force against an external resistance, whether that's another human being, a weight, or even the air, or a track as your legs drive into it, or right before you take off for a long jump, or right before a gymnast explodes off the pommel horse. Speaking of agility and dexterity, would you say gymnasts are fairly strong? I think so. Would you say that they're also pretty agile, like doing a triple flip and landing on their feet without moving? I'd say so. I think another example of that false dichotomy. So let's talk about the most trainable aspect of power. Well, it's strength, it's force production. The D in this instance is usually fixed. So whether that's the 100 meter sprint or a vertical leap or a running back accelerating from 0 to 20, that D is sort of fixed. So we're not gonna tinker with that, okay? The T is what some of these power trainers will tell you that they can train. They're not gonna train the strength, the force production, right? They're gonna train the T. And what they're telling you is that they can change the nature of your central nervous system. Now, athletic training will change your CNS. There is no doubt about that, and it will affect it. But it cannot affect it without increasing your strength, okay? The way to get powerful that's within your span of control, other than choosing your parents, is to train strength. And the way we know this is because there are people who are powerful without being strong. Okay, I'm going to say that again because it sounds crazy because of the way we think about what power is. We think of power as a big 300-pound guy throwing a beer keg 20 feet, right? Well, that guy's powerful, no doubt about that. But a skinny, whippet, 145-pound high schooler who's 5'11", skinny as a rail, who can vertical leap 36 inches is incredibly powerful because the strength he possesses can be exhibited incredibly quickly and explosively. What he doesn't have is a lot of strength. So when that guy hits you on a football field, you'll be fine. He doesn't have enough lead in his ass, and he also doesn't have enough strength to really deliver on his power potential. Now, what happens when that guy's 185 pounds? On the high school football field? He's gonna knock your ass out if he gets a clean shot and he knows how to hit. So that is a function of power. It's not just your body weight, but also his applied strength within the power function. In addition, strength, and this is a dichotomy, you've gotta wrap your head around this, strength expressed quickly is power. And the power in and of itself, natural power, what people call natural power, and you kind of know it when you see it, but it's also that guy who can vertical leap 36 inches before he's even stepped in a weight room. Natural power is genetic. It is genetic. It was not trained when he did that. Yes, I understand he plays basketball. Yes, I understand he's fit and he's always running around. That's not how he got that way. He got that way because of his genetics. His genotype is what is influencing how you view his phenotype. And so his ability to do that was a gift from God. And the great thing about it is by being more naturally powerful, you can actually train your strength better. So that's an illustration of the different sort of competing dichotomies. But they're not competing. They're complementary. And that is this: the best way to train your power expression is training your strength. And the easiest way to get strong is if you're naturally powerful. Does that make sense? Because once you sort of wrap your head around that and you realize that people who are naturally powerful, even before they can express that strength, are easier to train to be really strong. And similarly, people who aren't very powerful, their best means and mechanism of getting some power generation and increasing their power generation is training their strength. What is more debatable, and I think not always borne out by reality, is the idea that you can take someone who isn't very strong and then you're going to train just their power and make them more powerful. So, to give you an idea, a good strength building exercise is a deadlift, okay? If you say, I'm not gonna have someone do deadlifts, I'm just gonna have them do power cleans. That's fine, that's a decision, you can make that decision.
But if that someone isn't very strong to begin with, their deadlift is 300 pounds, and they're pretty powerful. You know, they've been selected. They're in a football, a college football locker room. They're a great athlete, probably. And you say, I'm just going to do power cleans with them over and over. You are actually not only limiting their expression of strength development, but you're actually limiting their expression of power development. Is that starting to make sense now? Because the way you can increase your power is by getting stronger. And the way in turn you can utilize that strength is by practicing your power and practicing those power movements. This isn't an argument against it. What I'm talking about is people who think wet streets cause rain. And there's far too many strength and conditioning coaches out there and so-called experts who think that, and they don't get it. And the reason is because of the genetic potential of the raw material that they're getting fed into their system. Because a lot of these guys are showing up already pretty strong, not strong enough, frankly, to be really great on a college football field, but pretty strong. And so if you just focus on developing their power, you naturally confuse their great vertical leap and the fact that they're gaining weight and getting stronger because they're moving from age 18 to age 22 while you're there. And by the way, they're in a weight room. You confuse that with you. You think you did that. But the truth is, you may not have developed that individual to the greatest of their potential. So I've thrown out a lot of different concepts, and some of them seem to almost be competing, right? This sort of dichotomous interrelationship. But if you can keep it straight, that power and its expression is a function of neuromuscular efficiency, and it is primarily genetic. To the extent that at which it can be trained, you can train it through increasing your strength. Now, conversely, if someone is very naturally powerful or has power potential, would be a better way of describing them, because they have that huge vertical, they're incredibly twitchy, they're incredibly fast and quick, but they're not even strong yet, that person you can get much stronger, much quicker than a person who's just the regular population. So it's all these fascinating interrelationships. But you as a strength and conditioning coach have to figure out what strong enough means. And by strong enough, I mean, irrespective of position, if a player keeps consistently and easily gaining strength while not getting to a weight that actually affects and hinders their athleticism on the field, then keep driving their strength up. It's only going to make them better. The minute it starts getting very difficult to grow their strength, such that you're having to create exotic, periodized programming with all sorts of nonsense and, you know, Bulgarian volume intermixed with Texas method 3-hour workouts and all this nonsense because you're trying to get the guy's squat from 600 to 620, not only does it take forever to do that, you're actually now detracting from the things that could make him a better football player. That time that you're spending doing all that stuff to get him stronger could be better spent working on his agility, working on his skills, working on his on-field ability, or in a film room. So there is such a thing as strong enough. But I am telling you that the Pat Moores of the world who think that a 315 squat is strong enough for a linebacker playing major college football, I'm telling you that he's wrong. And I don't care what his salary is. I don't care that he looks big and intimidating. I don't care that he says all these really exciting things and that he's got the job title and I don't, and he's making X amount of money and he's got a bunch of letters after his name and a certification. I'm telling you, he doesn't know what he's talking about, because he's failing to develop not only the strength of that player, but their ultimate power potential. And what he's really hoping for is that the incredible natural athleticism of these players that you selected for, let's recall, these aren't a bunch of random people off the street. You selected for them because they're freaks. And if you're in a college football locker room, you're a freak. A lot of these strength and conditioning coaches are hiding behind that. Again, I'll provide my disclaimer. I don't know what Tory Becton is training. He might say what I just said and said, yeah, obviously, I want to get people real strong and then I'm going to train their power expression. That's how you, I want to get people strong enough And then I'm going to focus on other things once they're a finished product. But the truth is that freshman who walks in the door, if you're just training his power expression, you're leaving a lot of meat on the bone. And not only in terms of that individual's ability to go get drafted or reach the apogee of their own potential, but you're leaving a lot of meat on the bone for your football team. And it can be the difference between an undefeated team and a 9-3 team. It really can. I don't think it's the difference between a 3-9 team and a 10-2 team. I don't think so. I think that's ultimately about the recruiter and about getting the right people on campus. But you do hear these cliches, right? You know, someone in response to this will write, well, strength is whatever, speed kills. They'll ignore the Ben Johnson example. They'll ignore the fact that the best way to gain speed is to gain force production. But it is true. You want a fast football team. You want speed. Speed does kill. But the main way to get speed is to feed speed into the strength and conditioning machine. Okay. If you can feed speed with your recruiting and then develop it even more, and then also make those guys actually strong in addition to being really fast, well, you got it made in the shade. And now you're talking about the Alabama Crimson Tide. You're talking about the Miami Hurricanes in 2001. But let's be very clear, if we're talking about maximization of the potential of what's already on campus, whatever you think of that talent level, I'm telling you that you have to have a considered, well thought through strength and conditioning program built on fundamentals. And that's not necessarily the things that photograph the best or YouTube the best or Instagram the best and get the recruits the most excited. At the same time, the strength and conditioning coach is also sort of a disciplinarian and a rules enforcer and all these other things. Like sometimes they're a confidant. And that's important too. I'm not underplaying that. But at the core, the strength and conditioning coach should be working on getting more strength and better conditioning. Not to hit the nail on the head there and be a little too on point, but that really is what it is about. And the question is balancing all these seemingly competing interests. Don't get the players too big and fat. No kidding. Just because you got their bench up because you added 40 pounds to a guy who already weighed 300, that's no bueno. That's not what we're looking for. What you're looking for is the best combination of attributes of strength, dexterity, precision, agility, speed, explosiveness. You want a combination of all those factors at the biggest weight that that player can exhibit those traits. And that's ultimately what it kind of boils down to. So don't hold it against a coach if prior coaches didn't pay enough attention to the fitness and conditioning aspect, but they probably had the strength aspect, pretty good. Don't blame the strength training for the failure to look at the conditioning and fitness and nutrition aspect. Nor should we take a nutritionist who's really got it dialed in and really understands athlete recovery and all these different systems. But if you've got a pretty weak input of strength and conditioning, if you have them doing machines and lat pull downs and freaking Cybex machines, you're gonna have a weak football team and they're gonna get their ass kicked on the football field every Saturday, okay? So what you've got to do is basically get, you're looking for good across the board. And if you try to get superior at any one thing, it will probably be to the detriment of some other components.
All right. So I'd be remiss if I didn't talk about the two aspects of the power equation. So what I talked about primarily was the outward display of power, right? It is the mechanism by which we judge the internal wiring of the power display and the power expression. So of course, the classic measure is the vertical leap. It's the uncontested proof of power or power potential in an athlete who's not yet been made strong or fully matured. It is the standard used by the NFL Combine. It's the standard used by ESPN or different Nike camps for a high school recruit when they do a Spark score. It's also, of course, the methodology used by the Soviet sports juggernaut of the 1970s and 1980s. They would go and measure a bunch of 10-year-olds in the vertical leap, and they would sort them out And the best vertical leaps would be invited to the Soviet sports schools. And the average to medium or worse vertical leaps would be sent to go work and die in coal mines. Gotta love the Soviet system. So there's another power formula that's happening. And remember, power is force times distance over T. Well, there's also a D and a T that's happening within your body. So I talked about just the outward display of that, but there's another power equation that's actually happening, right? The vertical leap or your ability to hit or accelerate on the field is an expression of power. It's a display of that power. The internal power is also a power equation, right? It's the stuff that allows that to be expressed. And I told you that that was primarily genetic. It's literally your neuromuscular efficiency. It's your ability to recruit as many muscles as possible quickly through the quality of your chemical, biological, electrical signals that go through your body, okay? It's your wiring. And it's almost entirely genetic. You can absolutely train it a little bit, but not a lot. Not a lot, okay? And that is why people use power and all those measures as an evaluative tool to predict athleticism. Because if you could just develop it easily, who cares what raw material you feed in? You could buy into the whole Malcolm Gladwell bullshit of 10,000 hours. As it relates to athletics, it's utter bullshit. And I'm talking about real sports. I don't care about whatever, you know, throwing darts or whatever. I don't care. But if you're talking about real sports, a good bit of this is happening with your parents and who your father and your mother were. And it's particularly relevant to power expression. So the formula that's happening inside your body is not the outward measure, right? There is a D and a T that happens in the display of power, right? It's when you do a vertical leap, it's how far you jump up, how quickly you jump up. In fact, you can measure a vertical leap without jumping up and touching something. You could just have someone stand on a plate, a force plate, and as they leap up in the air as hard as they can, you just measure the time that they were in the air. And you can actually extrapolate out a vertical leap. The reason people don't do that as often is because athletes psychologically will perform better when they can see a goal up above them, something to go up and jump and touch, right? And that's why they use the vertec, because you tend to get a better reading. Just like, you know, there's certain athletes who just seem to run faster when they're getting chased, you know, rather than if you just time them in the 40. It's a similar thing. And so what they find is you get a truer measure by doing that, but you can get a pretty good measure just having someone stand on a force plate, leap up, you time the amount of you know, a second or fractions of a second that they're in the air, and then they land, and you can actually extrapolate the vertical leap pretty accurately. So that is the outward display of power, but the internal display of power also has a time modality and a distance modality. It's literally the traveling of your signals through your axonal terminals, your dendrions, all these interconnected fibers of your CNS, and how quickly those electrical signals are displayed, and how quickly they travel over your body, and then how much of your muscle mass they can recruit. So that's the real power formula. I wanted to discuss the outward display of the formula as measured in the vertical leap or all these other different power measures or proxies. But there's actually two measures happening. And one of them, the one that's happening inside your body, is the reason you can have the outward display of the 39-inch vertical leap, right? So here's the fundamental thing to sort of tie this up with a bow. If you remember the formula of P equals F times D over T, what I'm telling you is that D and T in your body, in your internal wiring, in your makeup, in your genotype expressed as phenotype, it's mostly genetic. It is somewhat trainable, but not very trainable. But what is the most trainable part of your body? It's force production, because we know that you can take a fit, relatively healthy male who's 20 years old, or better yet, 17 years old, when they're coursing full of hormones and testosterone, and they're growing and everything they do, if they, you know, barely touch, look at a weight room, they'll get stronger. If you take that male who's never been in a weight room and you test them out, and let's say they can bench 135 and they can squat 185 and they can power clean, or not power clean, they can deadlift 185 and they can do 2 chin-ups, okay? If you take that person and they eat and they train hard in a real workout program, not bullshit, compound lifts. They're doing chins, they're doing deadlifts, they're doing squats, they're doing, let's say, bench press, you know, pick your upper body exercise of choice. And they're also doing some running, and they're recovering, and they're running hills, and they're eating a bunch of food, and they're resting, and they're not being jackwagons. That guy who is not a remarkable athlete, let's say he has a 20-inch vertical leap, okay? So he's not even a particularly powerful guy at all. You can get that guy to a 300 bench, 400 squat, a 500-pound deadlift, and he can do 12 chins in 18 months. That would be an unremarkable thing if you had that guy really dedicated to his program. So you can basically triple his force production, okay? Or 2.5x his force production. You could spend that same 18 months not trying to get him stronger doing those lifts, but spending all your time on his rate of force production. You're going to increase his power, right? You're going to train his T. You're going to train that internal D and T. And you're not going to worry about the force production as much. Now, the force production is going to go up just because he's touching weights and he's working hard. But if you just have that guy who's not even strong yet doing power cleans and doing box jumps and doing plyometrics, he's going to improve. He's going to get more fit. He's going to look better in his clothes, and he's going to feel good. He's getting good workouts, right? This is good stuff. There's nothing wrong with it. But he is not going to grow that vertical leap from 20 inches to 30 inches. He sure as hell is not going to grow it from 20 to 40. He is sure as hell not going to 2.5x his ability to affect his D and his T. In fact, what I'm going to tell you is he can improve the efficiency of his D and his T internally, right? His expression of the power that he has, which is not much because he's not strong yet. He can improve that expression by 10, 20, maybe 25%. So he's going to take his vertical leap from 20 to 24 inches or 25 inches in 18 months. Whereas the other guy probably took his vertical leap the same measure upwards, but he also is more useful now on a football field. He now went from weak to pretty strong for the general population. Now, I don't necessarily want that guy starting at linebacker for the University of Texas, right? But I'm just talking about the general population. And what's interesting is, the better the athlete, the better the raw material that you're feeding into that college football locker room, the easier you can make those guys stronger. It's just easier for them because of their neuromuscular efficiency and because of their ability to recruit muscles quickly. So the fundamental issue that these rate of force production trainers who emphasize rate of force production to the detriment of strength training as the necessary companion is that they think that they can make T smaller and then make that power equation better because they're not going to increase F very much and they're not going to do much with D. That's fairly fixed. And I'm telling you that T is mostly genetic. Is force production also have a genetic component? Oh, you bet. Alexander Karelin was a creation of hard work, but also he was born a certain way, okay? There's no question about that. But I'm telling you that F is trainable not only for elite athletes at a much higher level than T, but F is much more trainable for the general population. Every single one of you that's listening to this, who's fairly healthy and a healthy male, can significantly increase your baseline level of strength. And in so doing, you actually will increase your power production, even if you're not naturally a powerful person. Now, if you do this at age 49, you are going to rip your hamstring or your Achilles tendon trying to do real powerful, explosive things all the time. I can tell you that. But if you're young, you'll actually get more powerful, even if you're not a very good athlete, just by simply getting stronger. But if you spend all of your time doing plyometrics and timed power cleans and timed power snatches, and you're doing it with really small weights because you're working on your speed, you know, you wouldn't want to use a heavy weight because that might accidentally get you strong, and you can't move a heavyweight quickly. And we want to move quickly on a football field, right? These folks always kind of ignore the fact that the reason a 600-pound squat goes up slowly is because it's 600 pounds. If you put 225 on their back, the bar will go up real, real fast. And it's not that the person suddenly got more powerful because 225 is on his back. It's because the bar weighs 375 pounds less. So this whole idea of you got to train fast or you won't play fast, it's kind of a platitude. It's kind of nonsense. It's the kind of dumb shit strength and conditioning coaches spout and don't get challenged on because it seems to make sense. But if you really think it through, you're just not saying anything. It doesn't mean anything. And I don't know anyone who trains on a football field slow, right? I don't know anyone who's not going to get lit up running around half speed on a football field. So I think it's very important to delineate and understand what objective empirical evidence shows. And what that shows is that power, innate power potential, is largely genetic. So training the T and the D modalities, those two measures, is very difficult. And you should do it. You absolutely must do it. But you shouldn't spend all of your time doing just that, unless the person is already very strong. But the thing is, when you get a bunch of 18-year-olds in your football locker room, a lot of them aren't very strong yet, even at a maxed out, Texas high school football program. There's a lot of guys that come in that aren't very strong. And their biggest adjustment to the field of play at the college level is that they're weak and they can get grabbed and they can get ragdolled and they don't have a lot of strength. And the inability to drive up their strength will ultimately affect their power production. So it all goes full circle. And that is kind of what I want to stress about this. Again, I don't know what Tory Becton trains. I know that he has to put forth certain public statements and show certain things on YouTube and Instagram that's appealing to recruits and appealing to the average Joe fan who thinks that's what football training should look like. Lots of jumping around, lots of yelling, lots of shouting. Ooh, what's that machine? I've never seen that. Ooh, they're timing the bar speed. That seems sophisticated. Ultimately, they don't want to show a bunch of dudes doing heavy squats and deadlifts and then running, right? That's not very glamorous. It's fun to show rate of force production training. So I don't know the formula that Tory Becton is using. I don't know if he's doing 80% power training, 20% strength, or 80% strength and 20% power training, or if it's 50-50. I don't know. Or if it's segmented and specialized for each player, which would be cool. I don't know any of that. And you don't know either. And over time, we're going to find out. And the results will probably show on the football field over time. So that's my two cents on the whole subject. If you found it edifying and interesting, great. If you want to say that you have a cousin who trained rate of force production and he had a 20-inch vertical leap and then it went to 36 inches because he wore the special shoes that they sell on the internet and they have the elevated heel and now he can windmill dunk and before he couldn't touch the rim, cool. You're a liar and you're an idiot. So I'm probably not going to argue with you much in the comments. But if you got questions, if you got clarifications, let's talk about it, because it can be a really interesting topic. But it is one that is subject to analysis, and it is subject to certain proofs in both physics and what we know about genetics and even math, just math. Some of this is just math. So anyway, hope you guys found it interesting. I probably wasn't that interesting, but here's hoping.
Paul, we are so lucky with our sponsors and the family we've created here. And one of those guys we love is David McClellan. He's helped out all of our listeners and people in the EGAT family. And he's given free consultations. Look, he's a fiduciary financial advisor from Forum Financial. He's kind of seen every part of this business. I always talk about my dad being in this business. And he said, look, if you have someone who's seen it from every side and then has been a financial consultant, fiduciary, meaning he's legally obligated to work in your best interest, then they're just going to know certain things. They're going to know how this whole world works and that world works. And that's where David comes into play. Free consultations for all of our listeners. Give him a call and see how he can help you out. He can help build your wealth.
No question about that. Building your wealth, to me, that equals financial freedom.
Yep.
Find out that financial freedom number with David McClellan. Give him a call. Where at?
312-933-8823, 312-933-8823. You can email him. He'll get back to you right away. It's dmcclellan@formfin.com. It's a free consultation. Give David a call.
Do you need a realtor in Central Texas? Of course you do. We all need a realtor in Central Texas, even those of us who live in Dallas or Houston or San Francisco or Denver, Colorado. You need to go to Central Texas anyway. And the reason is Laura Baker is a fantastic realtor. She's great at what she does. She's a member of the elite Andy Allen team for Keller Williams. You can reach her at 512-784-0505. Talk with Laura if you're thinking about putting your house on the market. This is a great time to get market comps. If you're looking to buy in the market, you need all the help you can get. Call Laura, and it's 512-784-0505.